Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is David Mislin, an assistant professor in the Intellectual Heritage Program at Temple University. Professor Mislin is a historian of the 19th and early 20th century United States with a focus on American intellectual and religious history. He received his PhD from Boston University and has authored the recent book, Saving Faith, Making Religious Pluralism an American Value at the Dawn of the Secular Age. David has also contributed chapters to several edited volumes on religion in American life, and he has published or has articles forthcoming in the Journal of the Historical Society, Religion and American Culture, and Church History, Studies in Christianity and Culture. He is currently at work on a second book-length project, tentatively entitled Evil in America, The Cultural History of an Idea. Ooh, I think I'm sniffing out a possible future Halloween episode. Links available to these books and other neat stuff at our website, so please get over there, check out our Facebook page and our Twitter feed as well. You will enjoy them. David, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. I'm really excited to be here.
Historical topics are great because they generate some of our most popular episodes here on the podcast, so I'm really excited to be talking with you today about your new book and about how religious pluralism was reconceived around the turn of the 20th century, or what you call the dawn of the secular age. But here's what I'm wondering. You're a pretty young guy, and I don't know if you ever received the memo that young folks aren't supposed to be interested in things religious anymore, let alone the historical past. So how did you end up becoming a scholar examining the religious history of the United States?
Well, yeah, you're right. I guess I just missed that memo. But it's a great question. I really have been interested in this my whole life, and in some respects, it has been my whole life. I am a preacher's kid. My mom is a United Church of Christ minister, so I've grown up in the orbit of liberal Protestant churches, grew up Sunday school, youth group, all that stuff that preacher's kids get roped into. So in a lot of ways, what I write about has been the world I've lived in. And even more than that, you know, under the heading that history tends to be autobiographical, I went to a high school that was, at least at the time, the only successfully merged Protestant Catholic school in the United States. It was a merger of an Episcopal school with a Roman Catholic school. Somehow they made it work. But by the time I was in high school there, the largest percentage, the largest religious group represented in the student body was actually Jewish students. So we had this Protestant Catholic school, a really large Jewish population, and all of us, at least in high school, were sort of these agnostic, unbeliever types. So I've come to realize, actually, that my high school was a microcosm of the world that I've written about in this book, and that I study, and that I'm really interested in.
Yeah, that is really fascinating that you mentioned that, because we're going to talk a little bit later on about attempts to merge Catholicism with Protestantism, and Judaism works into this whole thing as well. So, you were pumped prime to write this book, I think.
Yeah, what's funny is I didn't even realize this until the book was out, and then I thought back. Obvious from the beginning.
Yeah, it's too bad you didn't realize that a little bit earlier. It would have been, you know, a nice prologue or something like that. You know, back in the time in high school and things like that. That would have been really cool. How was it being a preacher's kid? I think we need to have a podcast someday asking what it's like to be a preacher's kid.
Yeah, well, and also especially a preacher's kid who ends up studying your parents' jobs, essentially. I had a really wonderful wonderful mother who I think really understood the perils and the difficulties of being a preacher's kid. So, you know, I've heard the horror stories of being dragged to every Sunday school event, every youth group event, always being up on the pedestal as the ideal kid. And fortunately, I managed to avoid that. But it has given me insights, especially writing as I do about this world of mainline liberal Protestantism. It's been helpful to understand that world a little bit from the inside, particularly now that the mainline churches aren't what they once were in terms of membership and maybe public stature.
Yeah, you do have that interesting insight, and your book is absolutely fantastic in terms of connecting with an era of history that we don't oftentimes, well, we think about, but we don't think about the things that you do. You really uncovered some stones and found some really interesting things that a lot of people haven't. And it's all about religious pluralism and reconceiving it too. So that's kind of cool. Your book basically looks at the 50 or so years straddling the turn of the 20th century. So I think you bound it from about 1875 to 1925 or so. And a lot of people probably recall the fundamentalist movement. That was picking up steam back then. You think of folks like A.C. Dixon and Amy Semple McPherson and a few folks like that. But you start your book with an anecdote from a New England preacher who had a slightly different message. And one of those messages that a lot of people would think sounds out of place for that era. Tell us about this guy, delightfully named, by the way, Lyman Abbott.
Yeah, well, that's one of the fun things about this book. All these people have really wonderful names. They also had really wonderful beards. It's like the last period in U.S. history where you have these ministers with these, enormous beards, the preacher's beard. So, Lyman Abbott's a really fun guy.
They were hipsters before their time, huh?
Exactly.
So we're gonna expect, like, lots of hipsters to have kids and call them Lyman and stuff.
Yeah, and, actually, he lived in Brooklyn for a lot of his career. So, he really was ahead of his time. Lyman Abbott is, I think of as the quintessential person in this book, the quintessential Protestant minister that I write about in this book. As you say, he was descended from a very well-known New England family. He had spent some time as a journalist, and then he became a Congregationalist minister. And at the height of his career, he was able to blend those two professions together. He became the minister of the Plymouth Church in Brooklyn, which is a very, very famous congregational church. Henry Ward Beecher, who probably was the most famous U.S. minister in the 1860s and 1870s, had been the minister at Plymouth, and then Lyman Abbott became his successor. And Abbott also became the editor of a weekly periodical called The Outlook, which was a general interest newsletter magazine that was distributed throughout the country. It had a religious flavor to it, but it also covered news, politics, popular culture. And Abbott was able to use that as a platform for a lot of his religious views. So he's a really interesting guy and a very influential person. And, I use him as a way into the book because I think he really represented and articulated very well this new outlook on religious pluralism that a lot of Protestants of his mindset were beginning to articulate.
Yeah, let me go ahead and read the quote that you start off with, Lyman Abbott. And you can picture this guy in an old Congregationalist church. You can kind of smell the mustiness in here and that. And he had a beard, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so you can picture this guy up there in a beard. And here's what you quote him as saying. He says, quote, "In entering into Plymouth Church, you are not entering into a fellowship which teaches you to look upon all other churches as inferior. All religions, Jewish and Christian, Roman, Catholic and Protestant, pagan and biblical, all religions involve aspirations after God, which God has stirred in the human heart." Well, what's he talking about there?
Yeah, well, and I think the most important part of the quote is the context, which was this is a sermon that he preached at Plymouth Church on a Sunday in which he was receiving new members into the congregation. For me, at least, I feel like if I were to join a church, I would expect the minister to tell me something like, you picked the right church. You made the right decision here. You're going to be saved because you are coming to my church and not some other church, you know, let alone belonging to some other religion. And I think particularly in the late 19th century, that's what we would expect a Protestant minister to say to new members of his church. But, you know, as you've just read in the quote, he doesn't say that. He looks out at all these people who are joining his church, and, you know, he says, all these other churches, religious faiths are not inferior. Jews, Christians, Catholics, Protestants, even non-monotheistic religions, they all involve the same fundamental search for God, and they were all inspired by God. And I think it's such a remarkable thing for a Protestant minister to say in the late 19th century, and what's even more remarkable is that he wasn't the only one saying it. He was one of many, many very prominent Protestants who started to articulate this new outlook.
Yeah, you make a good point of that, because that was going to be my next question, is that this guy's probably just one crank out of many fundamentalist preachers that are out there, but he is representative of a number of other folks. Was this more indicative of the New England area, or was this spread throughout the entire country?
It was primarily an urban phenomenon, so cities, large towns, so obviously New England, the mid-Atlantic, but also there were some places in the middle of the country where there had been large numbers of immigrants who had come to the region, so places around the Twin Cities in Minnesota is a good example, Chicago, obviously, Pittsburgh. So it was primarily a northeastern phenomenon, but you could find pockets of it happening elsewhere, particularly the industrial Midwest, and interestingly enough, parts of the West Coast as well.
So we're going to talk about some of the reasons why this movement started taking shape and some of its successes and flops or failures and that. But let's set the stage for this era. You're again, as I mentioned, you're looking at a time frame from 1875 to 1925, give or take a few years here. And you refer to this period as the dawn of the secular age. And at another point, you also refer to it as the Gilded Age crisis of faith. What do you mean by those terms? And give us some overview of the religio-cultural landscape at that time and how it was really changing over those 50 years or so.
Yeah, absolutely. So the dawn of the secular age and the Gilded Age crisis of faith, I'm basically referring to this moment in U.S. religious history, but also I think in Western religious history more broadly, when unbelief really became an intellectual option for people. You know, there have always throughout history been people who doubted conventional religion in Europe and the United States, who questioned institutional Christianity. But as a number of historians and sociologists have documented very well, it was really intellectually difficult before the late 19th century to conceive of a natural world, of a universe, without invoking God or some kind of divine being. We just didn't know enough about science, the operations of nature, things like that, to be able to explain things without invoking some sort of divine power. That changed in the 19th century, and the final piece for that really was Darwin's theory of evolution through natural selection, which was just a, you know, enormous intellectual innovation that all religious thinkers really had to grapple with in the latter half of the 19th century. And certainly for many people, they were able to sustain their religious commitments either by, you know, choosing not to believe in new scientific theory or by reconciling the scientific theory with their new belief. But for many other people, evolutionary theory and other scientific developments of the 19th century really made it possible to adopt this secular worldview and to be able to understand the universe and the world around them without a divine being. And, you know, obviously with the growing spread of unbelief and the growing popularity of agnosticism that occurred in the late 19th century, that caused some other people to question their faith. And so this was a period of skepticism, of questioning, of uncertainty. And for many Americans, the adoption of a secular worldview. So that's what I mean by those two terms. But you also asked about the broader culture, and I think it's just important to acknowledge this was a period in U.S. history where it wasn't just religious ideas that were being called into question, but a lot of the broader assumptions of everyday life were being called into question. One of my favorite historians of this period, scholars of this period, Alan Trachtenberg, has described it as a period of trauma. And I think that's right. And in some ways, it's a lot like our own time. There was mass industrialization that changed the economy. You know, now we talk about disruption, but you know, this was a period where a lot of the usual ways of doing business were disrupted. There was an economic roller coaster, so the economy would boom one year and go bust the next. There was rampant unemployment, a lot of mobility with people moving around the country looking for better economic opportunity. So you know, this was like a period of crisis, a time of crisis, not just for religion, but for American society as a whole. And I think that's partly what led to this reconsideration of religious difference and ultimately of pluralism.
Now, you talked about the dawn of the secular age and a little bit about the Gilded Age, a crisis of faith. Mm-hmm. And that term, though, gilded, right? That's the it looks really pretty on the outside, but, you know, you look underneath there and it just might be a bunch of lead piping or something underneath that gold. And this gets you thinking, because if you ask folks today, oh, what did you think about the late 1800s, early 1900s? Go, oh, very religious. The fundamentalists were preaching with their hands up and making the rounds all throughout the country. It might be the case in some regards that many of these fundamentalist movements that arose at the time were in many ways a reaction to that secular age. So what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think there were a few options. If more and more Americans are becoming avowedly unbelievers, which happened in this period, there were a few ways for Christians to respond. One of those ways was to kind of double down on traditional orthodoxy. And, you know, as you say, that's exactly what we saw in the early 20th century with the publication of the Fundamentals and the birth of modern fundamentalism. But there were a couple of other options as well, and these were the options that most of the mainline churches, the Congregationalists, Episcopalians, Presbyterians, etc., these were the options that those churches decided to take. The first was to try to reconcile traditional religious belief with new understandings of science, particularly evolution, but also new understandings of biblical scholarship. And this collectively became known as the New Theology. It was a modern, accommodating theological outlook that insisted that traditional Christianity could be reconciled with new human understanding. So that was one piece of it. The second piece of it was what became known as the Protestant Social Gospel. So this was kind of a turn away from a lot of discussion of doctrine and theology and a focus on the practical. So these were Protestant ministers, Protestant churches who became very involved in social issues like supporting the labor movement, working to improve the conditions of the poor, things like this, and sort of making the focus on the here and now and improving the world. And both the New Theology and the Social Gospel have been documented really well by quite a number of historians. But there was a third piece to this response, to this Gilded Age crisis of faith, and that's what I explore in my book. And this is a piece that I think hasn't been documented so well, and that's this embrace of religious pluralism by mainline Protestants.
Yeah, let me go ahead and ask you about the mainline Protestants, because that you use the term liberal Protestants several times throughout the book. Mainline Protestants, I think, pops up every so often there. So the folks who are embracing the new theology, the social gospel, and then as well as this reconceptualization of religious pluralism, what denominations are there? Are they basically the Congregationalists? Are some Methodists involved in there? If we had to put some denominational names to these folks, who are these?
Yeah, well, you know, it's actually funny. Donald Trump, I think, gave these denominations their best attention a week ago when he was trying to contrast himself to Ben Carson, and he had that quote, you know, I'm a Presbyterian, Trump said, I'm middle of the road. I think what Donald Trump said is actually quite right. These are the middle of the road, old, established denominations, big city churches. So, as you say, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, Episcopalians, in this period, Methodists were sort of putting aside their earlier rural history and trying to institutionalize and build larger, more elaborate churches. So I would include Methodists in this as well, and also Northern Baptists. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those five denominations are kind of the core of what was going on.
And did they kind of recognize that they were the mainline Protestants or liberal Protestants? We take these terms and pigeonhole these different groups even today into the mainline Protestant, liberal Protestant, fundamentalist, etc. But I often wonder, you know, did they really see themselves as that, or did they have a different conception of who they were?
Yeah, I'm not sure I think they recognized that they were becoming theologically liberal. I don't think they would have identified themselves as liberal Protestants in quite the same way that historians do. I think they did recognize that they, these Protestants and their institutions had enormous cultural authority. One term that a lot of scholars use that I think describes them quite accurately is the Protestant establishment. These were people who were very much of the establishment class. They had cultural power. They had access to political power. Their churches, by and large, had access to money. You know, to go back to Lyman Abbott, who we started with, he was very close friends with Theodore Roosevelt. Found stuff in his correspondence, you know, planning, you know, trips out to Long Island, hunting trips, things like that. You know, so these were people who were very much on the in with political and cultural elites, and I think that's an important way to think about them and to understand them.
Okay, so we know who these folks are, a half dozen or so denominations at this point in time. You mentioned a number of them turn to the new theology, some of them turn to social gospel, but your book really focuses on this third part of their reaction, that's the embrace of religious pluralism. And you make a claim early on that an embrace of religious pluralism, and go back to that quote by Lyman Abbott, it's like, oh, let's just include everybody in this pot. No, you can't say any of these religions are bad or anything like that. But you make the claim that these are not relativistic claims, where all faiths are considered the same. There's some limits to how people conceived of this religious pluralism. Kind of explain that if you could.
Yeah, I mean, it is this kind of weird intellectual tension that you find in the writing and in the discourse of these people. It's kind of all faiths are good, but we're better, is what it seems to boil down to. You know, these were people who, in a lot of their rhetoric, were very focused on the idea of progress. In part, this reflected theories of evolution, which were just so widely discussed in the culture. This was also a period in American history where business, culture, everything was focused on progress, right? It's the progressive era. So the way that these Protestants thought about it was that human religious development was this kind of ongoing process of progress, where everyone had access to more or less religious truth. But there was contemporary mainline Protestantism sitting at the apex of religious truth. So that was how they managed to continue to view themselves as the most superior religious tradition, while at the same time granting a lot of religious authority to other faiths as well.
So you see superior religious tradition is mm-hmm. the idea that's floating out there. But interestingly, you talk a lot about this recognition of religious doubt, that these preachers, the intellectuals within this movement are also recognizing doubt, faith, you know, the doubt of the faithful. And how does that work into it?
Yeah, well, I mean, that, again, I think ties into this whole question of skepticism and unbelief that's going on in the culture around these mainline Protestants. it was really impossible to ignore skepticism in this period. It was just so widespread. And what they essentially did was create a kind of Christian form of skepticism. So you had the bad skepticism on the one hand, the skepticism of agnostics and unbelievers. Then there was this kind of Christian doubt. This was where people would express maybe some uncertainty about specific doctrines of Christianity or specific historical teachings. But at the same time, as people were expressing these doubts, they would express a desire to remain part of their churches, to continue their spiritual growth and development, in the hopes that maybe they would overcome their doubts, but maybe they wouldn't. But they would still be Christians. They would still be part of their church. And in the 1880s and 1890s, there's this really large shift that occurs in mainline Protestant thought to this embrace of this good kind of doubt and the expressions of welcome to doubters in Protestant churches. And I think this was the really important first step for the broader embrace of pluralism, because once doubters were allowed, it kind of made it okay for mainline Protestants to say, maybe we don't know everything. Maybe we don't have all the answers. Maybe there are some things we're wrong about. And once they took that step, it was very easy to look at other religious traditions and say, well, we still think we're the best, but maybe there's something in Catholicism or Judaism or even Hinduism or Buddhism that is better than what we do, or at least shed some kind of new religious insight. And so that was how doubt fit into all of this.
Now, another aspect of this embrace of doubt at this point in time, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier in terms of a progressive outlook on things, you talk a little bit about progressive revelation being involved in the theology here. What's that about?
Yeah, well, I mean, that is this idea, again, this evolutionary progressive development of human ideas. This was the idea that was so essential in mainline Protestant thought, that revelation had not been finished 2,000 years earlier, or 1,900 years earlier when the Bible was, when the biblical texts were written and then the biblical canon was finalized. But that there had been ongoing revelation throughout human history that correlated to humans' intellectual development. Basically, the more humanity knew, the more revelation humanity would be given. And the assumption was that revelation would continue into the future as human capacity expanded. And this was, again, another very important piece of doubt, because it was, these Protestants were acknowledging that they didn't know everything, and that there might be more religious information forthcoming in successive generations or centuries.
So who are some of the main characters in here? You already talked about Lyman Abbott as being a critical person, but there's a lot of other really great names involved in this movement, and you document them very well. Give us a flavor for some of the other characters in this story.
Yeah, well, there's so many of them. I focus in this book primarily on clergy and theologians. So one person who's really interesting is an Episcopalian named Leighton Park, probably my favorite name in the whole book. And he was another New Englander. He spent time, much of his career, in Boston. But he went in the 1880s on a multi-year trip to Asia. He spent time in Japan and also in China and India as well, I believe. And he was one of the Protestants who really pushed the boundaries of this embrace of pluralism beyond just Catholicism and Judaism, but really to Buddhism, Hinduism, and Islam as well. And this was all a result of his travels. And he was, I think, really interesting because in his writing, he suggested, which is just such a provocative statement in this period in history, he suggested that Christianity owed as much to religious ideas from Hinduism and Buddhism as it did to religious ideas that came from historical Judaism. And, so again, we see this idea of Christianity is the culmination of religious truth, but it's a really sort of provocative and, for the time, astounding statement that he's willing to see Christianity pulling almost equally from all of these other religious traditions in the world.
Any other folks involved in this? We got Lyman Abbott, Leighton Parks.
Yeah, well, so we have a bunch. We have Washington Gladden, who he's known primarily as a social gospeler who wrote a lot about labor issues and economic inequality. But he was one of the most outspoken voices in support of this new outlook on doubt, and really prolific, really beloved. His correspondence is just so full of people writing to him, expressing their appreciation for his religious ideas. There aren't a lot of women, unfortunately, who wrote about these issues, but one woman who did was a New England writer, essayist named Mary Abigail Dodge, who wrote under the pen name of Gail Hamilton. What I love about her, she published a book, I want to say it was 1876, called Sermons to Clergy, which I think it just captures her personality so fully. You know, here's a woman, she'd not been to divinity school, she was not ordained, but she published a, I think, probably 200-page book basically on her opinions of what the clergy should be telling people. And she also really embraced this new outlook on pluralism. She was also interested in Hinduism, Buddhism, and how they shaped modern Protestantism. Plenty of other people as well who moved in and out of the political realm, people who were involved in military policy. It's really such a fascinating cohort of people who lived and worked at a time when mainline Protestantism was so much more at the forefront of the nation's political and cultural life.
You do a wonderful job documenting the different characters in here, and I do want to point people back to your book. We'll link to it on our website called Saving Faith. And you do focus mostly on clergy and theologians, but I just caught you a moment ago saying, well, I focus more on those folks. That seems to imply that there were other folks involved in this movement. Were there other intellectual leaders that were toying around with these same ideas?
Yeah, I mean, there were a few, particularly intellectual leaders, people involved with colleges, universities. What's interesting, though, is that a lot of the Protestant leaders I look at were responding to, in some ways, a more inclusive form of spiritual experimentation that was happening among artists, intellectuals, people who had the time to do a lot of travel. So part of what this is in response to is a new awareness of Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, other spiritual practices that were gradually finding their way into American life, kind of in the intellectual and cultural elite. And these were people who were articulating almost what we would now think of as a kind of spiritual relativism. And the people I write about were responding to that, saying, wait a minute, maybe Hinduism and Buddhism have some truth, have some value, but we don't want to say that Protestantism, Hinduism, Buddhism can all be mixed together and you can pick and choose whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. You talk about a number of these folks. They seem to be from the intellectual class, artists, journalists, the clergy who've been trained at seminaries and such. What is their audience? Are they talking to one another, or are they trying to aim this to the typical congregant out there in the middle of Winfield, Kansas?
Yeah, well, that is the million-dollar question with this book, and it's something that I have really struggled over as I was writing it, as I was revising it. It's really hard to gauge how these ideas were received. This is a world before social media where we can't see how many likes, how many retweets any of these ministers got with their ideas, and I wish that we could. I would really love to know just how widely these ideas were received. It depends a little bit on the context. Some of these situations, some of these writings, they were clearly talking to each other or writing to each other. There are some glimmers of evidence that I found that suggest that these ministers and theologians were really trying to build up a groundswell in support of these ideas. And sometimes in letters to the editor, sometimes in the records of local churches, I find little hints that these ideas were starting to catch fire at the local level. But, you know, primarily this was an intellectual discourse among the elites in Protestant denominations.
Now, one of the chapters in your book deals with a very tangible manifestation of these ideas, and you already hinted at this. We talked about this being popular at universities, and there became a growing interest in the study of comparative religion, which I assume is largely brought about by people, as you mentioned, you know, Washington Gladden, who've been traveling around the world, because, you know, the time that you're talking about is there's more religious diversity opening up here in the United States. You're getting a wave of Catholic immigration, but it's still all pretty much Christian. But all of a sudden, Hinduism, Buddhism, this must be coming from a lot of people who are traveling, and then it manifests itself in this interest in the study of comparative religions. Speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. There is this, out of nowhere, I would describe it as almost a near obsession with Hinduism and Buddhism in the 1880s and early 1890s. And what's funny about that is there were just so few Hindus or Buddhists living in the United States, especially beyond the West Coast. So, as you say, that's exactly right. It's this rise of travel to Asia that happens in the last third of the 19th century. It was the popular destination, particularly for young men. Some practical things made it easier. The Transcontinental Railroad was finished. There was increased steamship service from the West Coast to Asia. So, you know, the world became a lot smaller at the end of the 19th century, and travel became easier. So it was primarily Americans going overseas, getting exposed to these new ideas, new religious practices, and then bringing them back that prompted this interest in comparative religion. And, you know, as you said, the academic study of comparative religion became quite popular, particularly with the rise of research universities. Johns Hopkins, Cornell, University of Chicago were all founded in this period as research universities with religion departments focused on the academic study of religion rather than just training clergy for ministry, and comparative religion was a major focus of these new departments.
Did these folks who start embracing this religious pluralism and thinking about, oh, you know, Hinduism, we really need to study this, we really need to take this seriously, did they face any backlash? I mean, I can imagine introducing a new university program and, you know, somewhere at Johns Hopkins or something is going to raise the hackles of a lot of folks.
Yeah, I mean, within the kind of elite circles supporting these universities, this was actually seen as exactly what should be done, you know, the scientific study of religion. I mean, these were people who were somewhat skeptically oriented, should we say, to begin with. Where there was a backlash was within the Protestant churches, who saw this as a sign that all religions were going to be treated as equal. People suggesting that Buddhist practice and Christian practice might be interchangeable. Fear was that there would be these new religious institutions that would mix and match whatever people felt like on any given day into this hodgepodge of spirituality. And mainline Protestants were extremely concerned about that.
So, we have these other religions, Hinduism and Buddhism, is becoming more interested in studying these things. But there was you're talking liberal Protestant America or Protestant America around this period of time, and there's this other religion out there that today we think of as not being one of these strange exotic religions, but at that time it was seen as very different, and that's Catholicism. And, you know, again, today, you know, Catholics and Protestants are very ecumenical in many respects. But back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there really wasn't. And one of the most fascinating chapters in your book talks about this movement to basically unify Protestantism and Catholicism. It was such an interesting phenomena back then. You devote a whole chapter to it. So tell us about this attempt to reunite Protestants and Catholics.
Yeah, I have to tell you, this is my, in some ways, it's my favorite chapter of the book. And it's the chapter that, even after, you know, 6 or 7 years of being working on, I've been working on this project, I still can't believe that this really happened. And I've gone back to the sources so many times to convince myself that this effort to reunite Catholicism and Protestantism was actually a thing, because it is just, it's so bizarre. You know, everything else that I document in the book, the comparative religion, the embrace of doubt, I mean, that all makes sense to me. You know, it's, you know, something that we live with the consequences of this today. But this effort to reunite Protestantism and Catholicism is so baffling to me. But it happened. So as you point out, I mean, one of the things that happened widely within mainline Protestantism was this new embrace of Catholicism, or at least appreciation of Catholicism, which was a major departure from the view of most Protestants in the 19th century. But there was a small group of Protestant theologians, Newman Smyth, Peter Ainslie, a few other people, who wanted to go farther than just warm, friendly relationships between Protestants and Catholics, wanted to go farther between ecumenical cooperation, and they wanted to see if they could really reunite Christianity into a single church. And for about a decade in the 1910s, there was this working group that tried to figure out, is there a way to negotiate theologically a reunion of Christianity? Obviously, it never went anywhere. And looking back through the records of the committee that was doing this, it's easy to understand why. They couldn't agree on anything. Every time they tried to find some common point that could be the basis of a reunited Christianity, somebody would disagree. You know, this one meeting where the minutes record that basically they argued for 2 hours, and then somebody made a motion to adjourn so that they could all go and pray. And, you know, I think that's about right. You know, they prayed a lot. They had this idea, but this plan was going nowhere.
It must have been very odd from the Catholic side of the table. I can kind of understand how some Protestants involved in this movement to embrace religious pluralism would say, yeah, we're all Catholic, or we're all Christian brethren. Let's just reach out and sorry about that whole Luther thing 400 years ago. It's all good now. But it must have seemed odd from the Catholic side, because the Catholics at this time, they're facing a lot of discrimination. There's the Blaine Amendments trying to keep them out of schools and make it very difficult for them to educate kids in the Catholic tradition. And all of a sudden, this Protestant comes walking by saying, hi, we want to reunite with you. I mean, what was the Catholic reaction to this?
Well, the Catholic reaction was very straightforward. They said, okay, you want to reunite, apologize for the Reformation, and come rejoin the Catholic Church, and we can live happily ever after. The whole thing was just completely bizarre. The Catholic Church never got on board with this. American Catholics were never even seriously considered these efforts. There were no, this committee to reunite Christianity didn't have any Catholics on it. And Catholic authors, Catholic writers frequently ridiculed the whole effort. I think what's important to understand is, and actually why I do spend a whole chapter on what really was a ridiculous failure, is it does show the limits of the Protestants' new understanding of pluralism. They really misunderstood what was happening in the Catholic Church. They misread the situation. They saw a couple of prominent Catholic leaders in the United States in this period who were more accommodating of modern culture, of American democracy, than Catholics historically had been. And these Protestants just latched onto those people and basically turned those people into what Protestants wanted them to be. And there was this whole assumption that was completely wrong, that the Catholic Church was essentially becoming like a modern Protestant church. You know, my favorite example of this, one of the theologians who really thought Protestants and Catholics could be reunited, this theologian wrote in 1910, I want to say, that he thought the Catholic Church was going to remake itself on the model of the United States government. And in this theologian's view, the Pope was going to become something akin to a president who was elected and had his power checked by the College of Cardinals, which was going to become like Congress. I mean, you know, completely ungrounded in any reality that something like this was going to happen. But these Protestants were convinced that was the direction the Catholic Church was heading, and that's what led them to believe that a reunification with Protestantism was possible.
Well, hope springs eternal, I guess. So.
Well, and it kept springing, for another two decades, for at least a few people.
Was there any lasting impact of this? Did this help to smooth over the path of ecumenical relations between Catholics and Protestants, or did it, in some ways, I could see it could set things back by, you know, the Catholics saying, wait a minute, you not only are you blocking our Catholic schools, but now you want us to become Protestants? No, we don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah, I think it depends on the people. You know, some Catholics just sort of wrote it off as craziness. I mean, I think the one lasting impact that it had was that it, these people were so out there, these people advocating the reunion of Protestants and Catholics were so out there that it did shift the terms of conversation a little bit. I think it gave some cover to ecumenical cooperation on social issues, which did happen quite a bit in this period. And so suddenly, if you've got people off on one end of the spectrum trying to reunite Christianity, the prospect of Catholics and Protestants doing a neighborhood canvas to make sure everybody in the neighborhood knows about a church, make sure everybody goes to the church they want to go to, suddenly that doesn't seem so bad. Whereas 20 and 30 years ago, the idea of Catholics and Protestants working together, particularly of Protestants helping Catholics go to church, that would have been completely crazy in the minds of many.
Yeah, I can see that. That's a good read of the situation, I think. But it wasn't just the Catholic Church that Protestants reached out to as well. You have another chapter that focuses on a faith tradition that dates back further than Christianity, and that's Judaism. And again, you're seeing increased Jewish immigration during this period of time. They're still a very small minority within the country, sometimes viewed very suspiciously. But here you have these liberal Protestant movements reaching out to these folks in something called the Goodwill Movement. What was that about?
Yeah, so this was a really fascinating movement that occurred in the 1920s, and I think it's probably the thing that would be most recognizable to modern readers as an interfaith movement. This was an attempt by Protestants and Jews to come together to foster interfaith understanding. It didn't have any of the implausible overtones of the Protestant-Catholic reunification effort. It was just, it was an attempt to bring people together to learn about each other's faith, to combat religious intolerance where it existed. I mean, it's worth keeping in mind that anti-Semitism was very much an ingrained part of American culture at this point. But just an effort to build interfaith friendships and, as the name suggested, goodwill between Protestants and Jews.
I want to finish off with a couple questions related to your study, one that you do address in your conclusion, or you actually called it an epilogue, and the other one that attempts to get your creative historical juices flowing. So let me start with the first one that you address in the epilogue. What has been the lasting impact of this general movement, from the goodwill movement of interfaith dialogue with Jews to the teaching of comparative religion in universities and other types of ways to reach out to other faiths? What, 100 years later, here we are, what difference has that stuff in the past made?
Yeah, well, I think this created the religious world that we live in right now in the modern United States. I think you, a few minutes ago, said something that was really telling when you asked the question about Protestants and Catholics. You said, nowadays to us, we don't think this is a big deal that Protestants and Catholics would cooperate. And I think that's absolutely right. Ecumenical activity does not seem like a big thing anymore. I can, think offhand of, dozens of examples of Catholics and Protestants having joint worship services, common efforts for, to benefit the community. It happens all the time, all throughout the country, and people don't give it a second thought. That was huge 100 years ago to propose something like that, and when it happened, it received a lot of attention. So I think the same thing, Protestants and Jews, doubt as a part of religious life. I think a lot of people now think that that is perfectly normal. So if you go through the chapters of this book, I think it's really striking how many of the innovations that occurred 100 years ago have just become an absolutely everyday part of the American religious landscape.
You know, after World War II, immigration picks up in the United States, and you see a dramatic increase in religious diversity in the latter half of the 20th century. And it seems that this movement that occurred 50 years prior to the beginning of that wave really helped to smooth that path. And had it not been for that, the situation would have been a little bit more culturally tenuous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think a lot of what happened in the late 20th century was made possible by what the people I look at did in the late 19th and early part of the 20th century. And I think it's what's particularly significant is it's a testament to the involvement of mainline Protestants in national life, in politics, in the broader culture. The culture at large. I think the people I wrote about exerted enormous influence on the national values of the United States. And, I think that's an important reminder, especially now, because we're so used to talking about the evangelical presence in American politics, which has certainly been the case in recent decades. But it's important to remember that for a lot of our longer history, the late 19th and much of the 20th century, it was actually liberal churches, it was the mainline churches who exerted an influence in the culture at large and really expressed their values in society at large.
So you talk about these characters, and this is where I want to pick one of the characters and get your creative historical juices flowing, and that's Lyman Abbott, who we started off with. You start off with in your book, you say it's one of your favorite characters. And I've always wanted to pose this question to a historian, because I think this is what you do in the faculty lounges all the time in the history departments. And that's if you had Bill and Ted going on their excellent adventure, and they went back in time in their phone booth and they picked up Lyman Abbott and brought him back to 2015 United States of America. How do you think Lyman Abbott would look at the world today, especially with reflecting back on what he was doing back in the late 1800s, early 1900s?
Yeah, it's such a fun question. I wish we talked about things like that in faculty lounges. Usually our conversations are much more mundane. But Lyman Abbott in 2015. I think he would, first of all, I think he would recognize that so many of our cultural values do reflect the religious message that he put forward. I think a lot of the broader ideas about inclusiveness, things like that, have found their way into the culture. So I think he'd recognize that. I think he'd be happy about that. On the other hand, I think he would be absolutely shocked at the decline of mainline Protestantism over the last 50 years. This was a guy who had the height of his career at the height of the mainline churches. And, as we've said, he was really a mover and shaker in the political and cultural world. And I think he would be really shocked to see the extent to which that's not true for mainline churches anymore. But here's my question, and I don't have an answer to this, but I think it is interesting to think about with Abbott and all of these other people. So their whole worldview was shaped by this idea of progressive revelation, that new religious knowledge would increase over time. What's interesting to me is to look at where their denominations have gone, issues of racial justice, LGBT rights, peace activism, environmental activism. You know, these are all issues that are now really at the heart of identity for their identity of liberal Protestants in the United States. And these are issues that Lyman Abbott and his contemporaries either wouldn't have thought of, or I think would come down, at least in their lifetime, on a much more conservative side of those issues than most mainline Protestants find themselves on now. And I think this is the test of progressive revelation. If Lyman Abbott came back today, would he sort of believe that revelation had continued to progress without him and sort of accept where mainline churches are today? Or would he be surprised and think they'd somehow gone off the track somewhere? And I don't have a good answer to that. I think he would probably go in the direction of assuming that sort of human understanding, human development had gone on without him. But I don't know. It's an open question.
It is an open question, and hopefully one that more faculty lounges will take up, and students and folks at large, too. It'd be an interesting conversation to have around the dinner table or with friends over coffee, so certainly worth thinking about. My guest today has been David Mislin. He is the author of Saving Faith, Making Religious Pluralism an American Value at the Dawn of the Secular Age. David, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Tony, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.